All right, we have been in the middle here of our Lent sermon series, and we've been talking about what it means to follow Jesus in a time when white Christian nationalism is on an upswing of visibility. And so this morning we're actually going to talk about something that I didn't originally intend to address in depth in this series, but I reconsidered as I was working through it, just given how foundational it is to Christian nationalism. And that is the embrace of traditional gender roles, both in family and society. Now, usually I don't talk about it because mostly I think it's a non-issue in this congregation. And frankly, I don't love to repeat negatives from the pulpit, and so I promise I'll be light on that part. But the more I read, I realized how intertwined they are. The sociologists Andrew Whitehead and Samuel Perry, the quote is on your handout if you need it, "Christian nationalism is the strongest predictor of holding a more traditionalist gender ideology. Even after taking into account a host of political and religious characteristics, moreover, the relationship between Christian nationalism and gender traditionalism holds across religious traditions, including more gender egalitarian groups like mainline Protestants and even the unaffiliated." So, in other words, even if you don't go to church at all, if you subscribe to more traditional gender roles, that is the best predictor that you also support Christian nationalism. So most American churches today, they peddle a softer version of patriarchy. So if you grew up in a more traditional stream, you probably heard something more like, "We don't think men and women aren't equal. Of course they're equal. We just think they're different, right? They're differently gifted in ways that make it so that men should perform certain roles, like, you know, leadership and pastoring and making sure they're in charge, and women more nurturing roles, right? That's sort of the Southern Baptists. I actually read an article, I hadn't read anything from Focus on the Family in probably 25 years, and they were trying to make the case they were more feminist than feminists, and I was like, oh my, here we go. Okay, sure. I am not going to claim that the Bible is an entirely progressive text when it comes to gender norms. It's not. The books were written in different times and different places, and we know patriarchy is as old as time itself. But what I want to do is just take a little tour through some of what I think are the most challenging texts with an eye on how gendered hierarchies were actually being challenged and not enshrined. So I think Genesis really starts out this whole biblical narrative with a challenge to gender hierarchy in a way that is subversive. And then I think Jesus and Paul after him were also actively pushing gender boundaries. So what I want to do is start with Genesis, and then we're going to hit some of those texts in the New Testament. Now, if you've been around a while, you know, I tend to preach on the beginning of Genesis a lot because origin stories are so powerful and so influential. And I think that the misreading of these chapters really underlies so many of the disagreements between what we might label, probably reductively, but what we might label like traditional or progressive theologies in the United States. Right? It's, do you read the Bible literally? And how does that affect things? Does it mean you don't believe in science or the theory of evolution? It affects how you think about gender and so on. So Genesis 1 and 2 contains a Hebrew origin story. Right, it's the story of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, and it's written in poetic form. Right, epic poetic narrative is the genre, and genre matters. I want to get like a t-shirt that says that. Genre matters. It's a poem. Right, we don't read poetry the way we read instructions for putting together our IKEA bookcase step-by-step manual, which thank God, because I always end up with like one of the shelves upside down, and I'm really glad I married Rachel, who follows the directions well. We understand, right, that poetry tries to get at truth and meaning through symbols and emotion and so on. And so we know Adam just means human, Eve just means sustainer of life, and so they're just symbolic representative humans. And so the poem at the beginning just paints this picture of God and humans and the animals and all of creation just living in harmony with one another, right? There's no rivalry, there's no fear, there's no scarcity of resources, there's no scarcity of care. And we see that the Creator walks in the garden alongside the naked, vulnerable humans, and there's no shame. But then we're told that the humans broke this tranquility, right? So that they ate of a tree that God told them to avoid, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, right? We know the story. And it's a tree that made them feel like they were adequate to judge others as if they themselves were God. But assuming this authority to judge other people didn't make their lives better like they thought that it would, or like they were told that it might. Instead, what it did was it brought hardship to all of the relationships. All right, so we're going to read a little bit here from Genesis chapter 3. This is the voice of the Creator speaking. To the woman, God said, "Your pains in childbearing will be very severe. With painful labor, you will give birth to children. Your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you." To Adam, he said, "Because you listened to your wife and ate fruit from the tree about which I commanded you, you must not eat from it. Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil, you will eat food from it all the days of your life. It will produce thorns and thistles for you." Remember, thorns and thistles, we'll come back to that. "You will eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your brow, you will eat your food until you return to the ground, since from it you were taken, for dust you are, and to dust you shall return." So I think traditionally, at least in the evangelical stream that I grew up in, this was often interpreted as like the chapter where God is doling out punishment. Like, you disobeyed, here's your punishment. But that's not how a lot of people read this chapter. It's certainly not how I read it now. The Creator wasn't doling out punishment for the humans for eating of this tree, but was telling them the natural consequences of their actions. Right? So in other words, when you ate from this tree where you felt like it gave you the authority to judge others, women, this is going to cause more pain and disconnect between you and your bodies. You're going to look to men and you're going to long for their support, but they're largely going to dominate you. Men, you're living out of harmony with the earth that feeds you, and you are going to work and work and work and work, and you're not going to see a whole lot of fruit for that work, and then you'll die. It's a nice bedtime story. Robert Alter points out that that Hebrew word that's used to describe the painful labor that Eve will undergo, I think I bolded it if you're looking at the handout, it's the same word that's used to describe the painful toil that Adam will experience in tilling the earth, right? So he says it's confirming the lot of painful labor that's to be shared by man and woman, right? It's painful for everyone. Now, there are many churches today that look at these verses and say, look, see, women should have babies and be ruled by men. And men should work and provide for their families. It's all part of the human design. It's a blueprint for how best to at least live until the next age. But I think that misses the point. Right? The text, I think, is making a general observation about humanity that largely rings true today. Right? That even while women don't usually like it, we're often ruled by men rather than treated as equals. And we've made a lot of strides in that area. I think there's some backlash going on. But there's some general truth to that that still resonates. Men often feel outsized pressure to work and to provide and to protect, even when work is over-demanding and becomes counterproductive for maintaining a healthy, well-balanced life. You know, I think I've said this before in other sermons, but I've found that like men in our culture tend to really suffer tremendously when they lose their jobs or are underemployed, because the American male identity is so tied up with work, and it's created a crisis for men. Right? There's a mental health crisis, depression, isolation, increased suicidality, and all of this men have been told not to talk about because they should be tough. And so there's parts of this story that I think we can find resonance in today as well. And the text is telling us, I think, that this was not the dream of God for humanity. Right? This was not the dream of God for humanity. The dream of God for humanity was the equality and the connection and the abundance and the playfulness. You know, they're going around naming animals and running around naked in the Garden of Eden in those prior two chapters. And so in that way, I think that the Bible is fairly revolutionary. I think it's critiquing this seemingly universal experience of humans right from the get-go. Right, that says that patriarchy and never-ending work are not the hopes of God for us. And so these connections, or these disconnections, I should say, between the ground that we work for food and between us and our bodies, and the disconnection between the man and the woman in the story who are no longer equals, and between the humans and God, as the humans now feel so ashamed that they need to cover themselves and hide from God. If you notice in the story, it says that the Creator made like some cloth of skin for them, which indicates that it sounds like almost like the creator maybe killed animals. So there's this like disconnect between the creator and the creation in a way that wasn't meant to be. And all of this is happening, even though the creator is looking at these like children that they made, and they love them like we love our own kids and our own grandkids and our own nieces and our own nephews. And this terrible thing has happened, right? This is a tragedy. It's a tragedy. It's not something we want to emulate, chapter 3. Emulating the gender disconnections is just continuing the tragedy. What we want to emulate is refraining eating from that symbolic tree of the knowledge of good and evil, right? It's refraining from judging others and eating only from the tree of life. So what is the tree of life? I don't know. You can find lots of probably different ways to go at it. I see it as like the life-giving force of the creator, right? That we draw our strength from love, right? From love embodied, not from lording our righteousness over others. Power from love, not from being right. I would say that, like, if you're Jewish, you could find all of what you need right in there. And I would say if you're Christian, as I am, I might add also that Jesus is part of that symbolism of the tree of life, since we believe that this life force of the creator became embodied as a human in Jesus. And several times, Jesus alludes to symbolically being this tree or being like this tree. And so the invitation is to focus on the ways of Jesus, on focus on the ways of love, and looking at what does it look like when love is played out in our lives instead of judging others. Right? Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount, he says, "Who do you think you are?" Right? Get that big old plank out of your own eye before you go and tell other people about that little splinter in theirs. Right? What's he talking about? He's talking about the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Right? You've got the tree of life. You got the tree of knowledge. And if we didn't understand that Jesus is kind of working with this same idea, he goes on to tell a couple of stories about two things. So the first one he goes on is to describe a story about two gates, a narrow gate and a wide gate. So Matthew 7, it's in your handout here. Enter through the narrow gate. Wide is the gate and broad is the road that leads to destruction. Many enter through it. Small is the gate and narrow the road that leads to life, and only a few find it. All right, so we've got this choice again, life and destruction. And if we still don't get it, he follows that with a story about two trees. He said there's a tree that bears bad fruit, and there's a tree that bears good fruit. He says choose the one that bears good fruit, not the one that leads to pain and domination and suffering. He says, do people pick grapes from thorn bushes? Remember we were looking at that. Or figs from thistles? Right, that's a deliberate echo there of Genesis. Right? It says the cursed ground will produce thorns and thistles for you. And Jesus is like, don't choose that, right? Do grapes come from thorns? Do figs come from thistles? Do we see what he's doing here with Genesis? He also broke all kinds of gender rules. There's a story in Luke chapter 10. This is a little bit, this is like a scripture-heavy sermon here. We're going to get into it. So as Jesus and his disciples were on their way, he came to a village where a woman named Martha opened her home to him. And she had a sister called Mary who sat at the Lord's feet listening to what he said. But Martha was distracted by all of the preparations that had to be made. And she came to him and she asked, Lord, don't you care that my sister has left me to do work by myself? Tell her to help me. Martha, Martha, Lord answered, you are only worried and upset about many things, but few things are needed, indeed only one. Mary has chosen what is better, and it will not be taken away from her. Right? So the traditional reading of the Mary and Martha story has us believe that Mary's choice to rest and to be subservient and to be meek and that her more contemplative nature were better than Martha's task-oriented nature. Any of you guys hear that growing up? Some of you had a little of that teaching probably. What we miss, I think, in our modern reading of this story is that Mary was sitting at the feet of Jesus in the men's portion of the house. Right? So when they had people over, the men would have sat probably in the front room and the women would have been in the back room. And so what had happened was Mary went into the men's room and she sat in the position of a rabbi in training at the feet of a renowned rabbi. And so Martha was angry with Mary for acting, you know, quote unquote, like a man, instead of staying in the women's portion of the home and helping prepare the meal. But Jesus tells Martha, Mary chose what was better because Mary followed Jesus' invitation to be with him in a place that was traditionally out of bounds for her. Right? I sometimes like to say, free Martha. All of you, whatever gender you are, if you relate more to like, I just like doing things behind the scenes, I'm way too ADD to like do contemplative prayer, rest assured, your action-oriented, non-contemplative personalities are just as God-given as Mary's. I think it was the boundary breaking here that Jesus was affirming. And then the earliest meetings of believers included, you know, there were female apostles and deacons and teachers and church planters and funders. We don't know that much about her, but we know there was a woman named Lydia who was a purple cloth dealer. So probably upper class, she was probably dealing in very fine, expensive textiles, and she opened her home to people. Both Peter and Paul's versions of the old household codes broke with tradition by instructing men and women, slaves and masters, to eat together and to submit to one another. Now, we've talked before about how as many as 1 in 3 Jewish people in Palestine, Roman-occupied Palestine, at that time were slaves. Probably 1 in 4 in all of the Roman Empire. Rome was a slave society by that point. It's very possible that Jesus' mother, Mary, was also a slave. She refers to herself twice as such. And so the early Jesus-following people were doing things differently from the culture of Rome. They were trying to break down these power structures that were oppressing people, and they were modeling what that could look like in their meetings. And you might say, oh, well, there's that weird verse in Ephesians that says that Christ is the head of the church, just like man is the head of the woman. Well, the word that's used there for head in Greek is best translated as source. Right? Christ is the source of the church, just like man is the source of the woman. And all this alludes to is that origin story back in Genesis, where it says that the woman was taken from the man's rib, right, and then fashioned into herself. And again, it's poetry, right? It's not a literal rib. But we notice that God symbolically didn't take the woman from the head of the man that she should rule over him, didn't take the woman from the foot bones of the man that she should serve him, but from his rib, right, that she would serve right alongside of him. And so when I think about this, like Christ is the source of the man as is the source of the woman, there's actually a real elevation here, even of humanity, like kind of co-partnering with God, like serving side by side as we sort of extend the good realm of God in life. Now, one of the passages that I think often rightly bothers us modern people reading is one that's found in 1 Corinthians 11. It's a really weird passage if you read it. You're like, it says something about like women should maintain, keep their heads covered because of the angels, and literally nobody knows what that means. But Sarah Rudin's book, Paul Among the People, was helpful to me in general in that text. She described how in the city of Corinth at that time, where the church was meeting, it was upper class, respectably married women who covered their heads. And not very many women were qualified to have such marriages, right? It was a luxury for the free and for the well-off. Many of the women were household slaves or prostitutes. But in that early church, said women of all classes mixed and mingled. And so this veil ended up creating a hierarchy of sorts between the women in the church, and it sort of distinguished between the respectable women and the women who were maybe of a lower class. And so it was this hierarchy that the Apostle Paul didn't want to reinforce, right? And so the way that he tried to solve that was to just have all women wear a veil in church so that prostitutes and slaves would be seen as respectable equals, not less than, right? So personally, I feel like I can understand that intuition that Paul is trying to tap into, right? He's trying to give dignity to people and put them on equal footing in the faith community, right? So these are probably the biggest hot button places in scripture that are most often waved around to support the idea that men should rule over women or that we are differently gifted. And I think this doesn't even touch on, we've done a lot of work on the gender of God, right? That it's most orthodox to say God is beyond gender. But when it comes to the patriarchy of white Christian nationalism, I do want to note that like theology isn't the only issue that's going on, right, with that patriarchy. I actually often think culture influences theology more than the other way around. Patriarchy exists outside of religion, but it's kindling, right, this theology on this larger fire. And I feel like we, in our churches at least, can address this particular stack of kindling, right? And I think if you'd like a more in-depth resource on how this poor theology has become entwined with hypernationalism, that book, Jesus and John Wayne, that came out a couple of years ago, Dr. Kristen Cobes-Dumez, who's at Calvin College, wrote it. I think she does an absolutely outstanding job of connecting these American narratives about rugged individualism and manifest destiny and white supremacy and male heroism, right, the cowboy, and how these influence the theologies of so many churches across our nation. And she also, I think, addresses well this sort of Bermuda Triangle of forces that has led to the widespread abuse of women and children. And I would also add general violence in the public square, which we're going to talk about more next week. We'll talk about Jesus and violence. But Dr. Cobes-Dumez says, many of the men implicated in the abuse, she's speaking particularly of the Southern Baptist Coalition, but also the Catholic Church, or in covering up cases of abuse, were the same men who had been preaching militant masculinity, patriarchal authority, female purity, and submission. And if nothing else, Jesus said we would know false prophets and false teachings by their fruit, right? And so I'd say we can see the fruit of it, and it's a little bit rotten. All right. Thanks for hanging in with me. I know that was a little bit denser. I'm usually a little more, you know. I'll just add, like, on the end, like, I really don't like even repeating these things because I feel like we're, like, beyond this. And yet I know that there are a lot of people still, like, maybe we just haven't even had them addressed. And so maybe it's helpful now and again to do that. So I hope that was okay for you, if that's the case. It caused me a little more stress. Rachel knows. I'm like, oh, man, writing a sermon about that is still kind of, anyway, I hope it sets well with you, and I hope maybe it helps us feel a little more free in where we're at. All right. We usually do a minute or two of silence or guided meditation, and this morning I am just going to invite you into a place of silence. If there was anything in the sermon that maybe you wanted to just bring before God, feel free to do that. Or maybe you're coming in with something completely different that has been on your heart this week that you just need to spend a little time with the Spirit here. I invite you to do that. People make noise. Little noise is all right. I'll let you know when it's up. Come, Lord Jesus, in this space. Jesus, we confess that we still have our own caste system here in our country, and I ask that you would show us, as your community of believers, how we can even better embody the values that you were trying to teach us, that we would break down those social hierarchies and that we would see each other as equals and that we would help to proclaim that in the communities and spheres around us. Lord, I ask that your Spirit would comfort people who have been really harmed by these teachings, that you would just feel near to people for whom this is still tender. I ask that you would better teach us how we can eat from the tree of love and to draw our strength and our wisdom from that space, even when it's messier, even when it means we don't completely see or understand or have the answer. I ask that that would be our life stream, and that as much as we are able, we will avoid from drawing from that tree of knowledge of good and evil. We ask that you would just bring restoration in our relationships with the earth around us, with our families, with our own bodies and minds, and with our communities. We ask this in your name. Amen.